Good afternoon, everybody. This is Scott Stevens, and we're going to be visiting you with a conversation about the news of the day and also an important issue, banks in the history of America and where we are today. Stick around for that. Difficulty within the financial system here in America, if you haven't encountered it already, it is right around the corner for you, to be sure. I'm going to take a look at the banking systems that have come into existence in America and where we are today with regard to that, as well as where we were in history with the banking systems and how they were created, what led to their inception. Before that, we've got more news from Israel and Iran. Intelligence services in Israel say that the names of 60 Iranian experts employed by 11 different Iranian agencies under the control of the Iranian Defense Ministry were revealed on May 12th by the main Iranian opposition, Mujahideen Khalik. This is the first time an extensive, highly secret, central organizational structure dedicated to the building of a nuclear weapon has been revealed in detail. Specifically, the Ministry of Defense, under the command of the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which also runs the Fordow Fuel Enrichment Plant. That is the plant in which the Iranians are enriching their government. Well, I'm hoping, I'm reading in the chat that my intro was a bit garbled. I could do it again. I mean, my hope is things have straightened out now and that we're moving along all right. I mean, there wasn't anything terribly important other than what we're going to talk about here today, which I'm already into. So if people would let me know whether that's coming through all right on the chat at this point, then we'll just continue to move forward. The Fordow plant over in Iran is the one where uranium is pushed from the authorized 5% enrichment to the 20% enrichment that is just short of what is needed for weapons grade uranium from which atomic weapons are produced. And the problem with this is that it contradicted the fundamental conclusion that was reached by the U.S. and the five world powers and the International Atomic Energy Agency that Iran's nuclear program is not run by a single organization, on the basis of which they entered into negotiation with Tehran. Most of all, it refutes another key argument heard in the West that Iran has not yet decided to actually build a weapon because Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, said it would be a sin. The Mujahideen Khalik, which Tehran accuses of collaborating with the U.S. and Israeli intelligence to assassinate its nuclear scientists, clearly timed the publication of its findings for 11 days before the six powers were due to hold a second round of nuclear talks with Iran in Baghdad on May 23rd. Intelligence sources and Iranian sources reported. Ahead of the meeting, U.S. administration sources put about word that a compromise deal developed in the direct backdoor channel between Washington and Tehran had a good chance of coming before the meeting. It was said to consist of 3 points of accord allowing uranium enrichment up to 5% purity to continue, barring enrichment up to 20%, and exporting Iran's entire 20% in stock to prevent its use for bomb production. Iranian intelligence sources say there is no such deal. Tehran is not willing either to stop 20% uranium production or shut down the Fordow plant. Just the opposite. The only Western publication following this is being published in Israel. Here in America, we are being told that all is well in this deal with Iran. and my sense of things, and in accordance with what is being said in Israel, is that you're not going to have to wait very long to find out whether or not Iran is actually telling the truth, that they are not interested in producing a nuclear weapon, or that they are lying and that a nuclear weapon is exactly what they're after. That's certainly what we believe here and what Israel believes. Indeed, it's all about money here in the United States. All about money. And you know, it wasn't always that way. We spent a lot of time here on the Jesus Factor speaking of the role of the church in history. And out of the annals of radio programs that I have done in the past on political topics, one of the most important and critical ones for people that are Christians and that are not to understand is the nature of the banking system that we're currently operating under here in the United States. It is by definition a conspiracy. And if anyone not authorized by the government engaged in the practices that the Federal Reserve banking system engaged in, they would be shut down and thrown in jail. We're going to get to that. But I want to start out by going back in history a little bit and seeing exactly what the Constitution for the United States articulates as who and where authority lies for the creation of money. And then we'll take a look at why that is. Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution authorizes the Congress to coin money and to regulate its value, and of foreign coin, and to fix the standard of weights and measures. It is a simple paragraph. Now, of course, the idea that authority for these things can be delegated is central to the thinking of the modern politicians that we have in Washington today. But such delegation was not as straightforward for those that were in place during the founding era of our country. One of the reasons for that is that God's word speaks clearly to the idea of just weights and measures. In Leviticus 19:36, it says that just balances, just weights, a just ephah, and a just hin shall ye have. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt. In Deuteronomy 25:13, it says, thou shalt not have in the bag diverse weights, a great and a small. In Proverbs 16:11, it says, a just weight and balance are the Lord's. All the weights of the bag are his work. And in Proverbs 20:10, it says, diverse weights and diverse measures, both of them are alike abomination to the Lord. In Proverbs 20:23, a similar verse, diverse weights are an abomination unto the Lord, and a false balance is not good. What all of this means is that the valuation of things, according to both the Word of God and our original founding documents, shall be fixed, not on some kind of a sliding scale. This included, as regards the Constitution, the value of foreign coin in relation to United States currency, and it provides that Congress, not an outside institution, shall be responsible for setting these values and establishing their relationships to provide for a fair and stable marketplace. And more importantly, to most of those who inhabited these colonies before they became a country, that this nation be founded and operate in accordance with the Word of God, knowing that no good thing could come of it if it operated outside the standards of the Word of God. The first bank of the United States was a central bank chartered for a term of 20 years by the United States Congress on February 25th, 1791. The establishment of the bank was included in a three-part expansion of federal fiscal and monetary power, along with a federal mint and excise taxes, championed by Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury. Hamilton was a very strong Republican who favored a powerful federal government. At the time, there was a good reason for this, as the states were factioned in many cases. The South was an agricultural area, and the North was a more industrialized, very specifically on the coast, a shipbuilding area. So how the money would be spent and how it would be apportioned was a critical question for people like Hamilton, who believed that the federal government needed to play a central role in financial control. The establishment of the bank also raised early questions of constitutionality in the new government. Hamilton, then Secretary of Treasury, argued that the bank was an effective means to utilize the authorized powers of the government implied under the law of the Constitution. Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson argued that the bank violated traditional property laws and that its relevance to constitutionally authorized powers was weak. He also identified the bank as a source of corruption and a system whose design would be difficult for the average person to understand. These are primary features of central banking institutions and have been from the dawn of time. Jefferson wrote, Hamilton's financial system had already passed. It had two objects. First, as a puzzle, to exclude popular understanding and inquiry. Second, as a machine for the corruption of the legislature. For he avowed the opinion that man could be governed by one of two motives only, force or interest. Force, he observed, in this country was out of the question, and interest, therefore, of the members must be laid hold of to keep the legislative in unison with the executive. What this means is that the money powers would be used to control the political system. If Jefferson's language is obscure to those of you that have not heard or read much from the founding generation, that's what he's saying, is that Alexander Hamilton's scheme with regard to the First National Bank is one that would make the executive and the congressional branches work more together. The design of the Constitution was to pit these elements of government against one another so they could not conspire against the people. And when put together with the money powers, that conspiracy, in Hamilton's own words, the idea to promote certain interests, that conspiracy becomes one of active, serious force among the people. And the idea that the nature of this system is not well understood by most people, even then, when it was far simpler than the system we labor under today, was clear to the founding generation of this country. Another argument came from James Madison, who believed Congress had not received the power to incorporate a bank or any other government agency. His argument rested primarily on the 10th Amendment, that all rights not endowed to Congress go to the rights of states or the people exclusively. This was the beginning of the undermining of the power of the 10th Amendment to allow states to decide for themselves how certain matters would be settled. Here on the Jesus Factor, we have talked at length on how the 10th Amendment was undermined further during the period known as the Civil War in this country, with the idea of racism as the key arguing principle, when in fact, the principle that was of greatest concern to those in power was money. It has always been about money. Other issues are used to manipulate the public who does not understand or clearly reconcile what the motives of the government and the money powers are. That failure to reconcile those things and realize what they are in fact all about began very early in our history and has proceeded to a crescendo of almost absolute ignorance in the American public today. Ultimately, Washington signed the bill after some discussion about the bank's private nature relative to its constitutionality and the authority to delegate the money power. In Washington's mind, a very serious natural authority delegated to a private entity. But he signed it. Part of the reason for this was the indebtedness, and this also becomes a part of this great overarching pattern of how banks, as private entities, exercise authority over the governing powers, rather than your vote and your opinion having anything to do with what they're doing at all. Once the country is in debt, some means must be found to relieve that debt. Politicians are unlikely to want to bring that problem directly to the taxpayers because they may not get reelected if they do that. So they have devised in history a number of different schemes dealing with unjust weights and measures, elastic money, to make it possible for them to remain in power and for you to remain ignorant of their ultimate aims. The first bank's charter expired in 1811, and the financial state of the bank was not healthy at the time. The option to recapitalize the bank through raising taxes was presented to Congress, along with the option to sell the bank and use the revenue from the sale to offset losses. Congress naturally chose the latter. Now compare this to what happens when a private business fails today. If the business is big enough, the government will raise taxes or monetize debt, a subject that we'll get into a little later on the program, to fund that business. You remember Chrysler and Chevrolet, and you remember what happened during the real estate debacle when a huge amount, three or some more trillions of dollars, were monetized in order to prop up a banking system that had failed. This also is a common tendency. The banking business's interest is favored above yours as a function of this incestuous relationship. Always. It is never the interest of the average guy, the taxpaying American, but the interest of corporate entities believed to be essential to the running of the country that holds sway over the political class. As we shall see, this tendency with regard to the central banking of the day has re-expressed itself throughout the term of the modern central bank we now know as the Federal Reserve, which, as we shall see, like the first bank, isn't federal, and like most national banks today, hasn't any reserves. Another matter of interest and perhaps greater importance is that severe financial crisis or other emergency has typically been the justification that the government uses to establish and recapitalize its central banks. In fact, as we shall see, the national doctrine and use of war and emergency powers is closely linked to the federal government's incestuous relationship with the banking system and its ultimate infidelity to the Constitution and to the people. In the case of the first bank, it was debts from the Revolutionary period that largely justified the setup. The second bank of the United States was chartered in 1816, 5 years after the first bank lost its charter. The second bank was chartered by many of the same congressmen who in 1811 had refused to renew the charter of the original Bank of the United States, and the predominant reason was that the second Bank of the United States was created to deal with the severe inflation that was a result of the War of 1812, which had created difficulty in financing military operations. This emergency situation caused the credit and borrowing status of the United States to fall to their lowest levels since its founding. Much of this was the result of trade imbalances created by the cost of the war. But rather than make adjustments in tariffs, which might upset the industrial North, where Congress had a clear delegated authority, they chose to place the financial future of the nation in the hands of a private banking institution once again. Like the first bank, the second bank was also chartered for 20 years and also failed to have its charter renewed. It existed for 5 more years as an ordinary bank before going bankrupt in 1841. So it was privatized and then finally went under. The second Bank of the United States provided a way for the government to handle its financial affairs. The bank was created when James Madison and Albert Gallatin found the government unable to finance the country in the aftermath of the War of 1812. That war had put the United States in significant debt, and the First Bank of the United States had closed in 1811. The debt of the nation led to an increase in banknotes among the new private banks, and as a result, inflation increased greatly. As a result, Madison and Congress agreed to form the Second Bank of the United States. After the war, despite the debt, the United States also experienced an economic boom due to the devastation of the Napoleonic Wars over in Europe. The damage to Europe's agricultural sector led to the United States agricultural sector undergoing a great expansion. The bank aided this boom through its lending. And you will recognize this pattern now. The bank aided this boom through its lending, which encouraged speculation in land. Land is real estate. This lending allowed almost anyone to borrow money and speculate in real estate, sometimes doubling or even tripling the prices of the real estate. The land sales for 1819 alone totaled some 55 million acres, the biggest real estate boom in American history to that day. With such a boom, hardly anyone noticed the widespread fraud occurring at the bank, as well as the economic bubble that had been created. Does this sound familiar to anybody out there? In the summer of 1818, the national bank managers realized that the bank's massive overextension and instituted a policy of contraction and the calling of loans. This might also sound familiar. This recalling of loans simultaneously curtailed land sales, devastated the real estate market in modern terms, and slowed the U.S. production boom due to the recovery in Europe. The result was the Panic of 1819. This was a big bank run. During the later years of the bank's charter, President Andrew Jackson became an avid detractor of the bank. As president, Jackson worked to rescind the bank's federal charter. In Jackson's veto message, the bank needed to be abolished because of these several points. It concentrated the nation's financial strength in a single institution. It exposed the government to control by foreign interests. This was the one that was most of greatest concern, even back then. The idea that international investors, in the wake of bank failures, could come in and buy up large portions of United States real estate and convert them to their own uses. You see, back then, people were concerned about such things. They didn't view it as a business deal. They viewed it as a disloyalty and a discontinuity with the American ideal. The banking system, according to Jackson, served mainly to make a few rich folks richer. It exercised too much control over members of Congress. It favored the northeastern industrial states over the southern and western agricultural states. And the banks were controlled by a few select families. The bank's charter expired in 1836, and efforts to charter another national bank, while diligent, did not succeed for another 75 years. Now, it would be inaccurate for us to say that banks, be they national or otherwise, are the cause of financial problems in the world. It is the world's failure to live within the standard of just weights and measures that the Lord has prescribed, and the recognition of the love of money being the root of all evil that brings these problems into existence. Not money itself, but the natural man's preference for money over the things of the Lord. And as we should be beginning to see, that preference is what allows for the establishment of banks and other institutions that would forestall or eliminate our responsibility to pay as we go. This is actually a corollary to the just weights and measures standard cited earlier. You will see what credit does, both for the individual and for corporations and governments, is that it allows the illusion of wealth. This is a form of false measure that at least some, if not all of us, have fallen into. I know I have. And those unschooled in the word live this way without knowledge of its short and long-term consequences, and so in ignorance believe that there is no other way. Central banking schemes are very large-scale examples of how the love of money drives men to excesses. Banking schemes allow public and private institutions and individuals to pretend to great wealth when they are not actually well off. Think of our situation today here in America. We will go into the national debt a little bit later in the program. These systems promote covetousness and pit men against men, one another, for illegitimate gain. These excesses lead to economic boom and bust cycles rather than the blessings of God. And these are at best a boon to a small few and at worst a curse to all of us. At the same time, where there is a godly people present, such a system can be a blessing to business and the individual. And this is always the rub here on the Jesus Factor. We can hold institutions and governments responsible for these things only in such a measure as we ourselves walk in the truth of God's word and don't allow these things to come into being as so many generations before us argued against them based on the principles of God's word. So while we believe it is obvious that all national banking schemes, in the absence of hard money, gold and silver, or other standard weights and measures, are especially vulnerable to corruption. We also recognize that banks as businesses are not the cause, but actually a great effect of the problem of sin in man.
Stream.
of leaving Las Vegas there. Of course, there are those that leave Las Vegas with a pocket full of money, and then there are those that leave Las Vegas financially destitute. And that is really what these banking systems are all about. They're run by a select few who have extraordinary wealth in their control. And they allow a certain number of people to become wealthy to keep the gears turning and keep the money coming in. There is perhaps not a greater financial conspiracy, one that is against an entire people, than our present national banking system known as the Federal Reserve. The concept for the system evolved out of a meeting of wealthy financiers on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia in 1910. There were seven principal players in the system's development. These were Nelson Aldrich. He was Republican whip in the Senate and chairman of the National Monetary Commission. Abraham Andrew, the Secretary of the Treasury. Frank Vanderlip, president of National City Bank of New York, America's largest bank at the time and the one that represented Cohn Loeb, a Wall Street international investment house that here on the Jesus Factor we did a show on and showed through the money trail that it was that money that financed the overthrow of Tsar Nicholas and resulted in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. This began the rise of world socialism, the end game of which is the monetary six in the 666, the other two sixes being government and religion. Don't believe it? Stick around. And then Henry Davidson, then senior partner of J.P. Morgan, Charles Norton, president of the First National Bank of New York, Benjamin Strong, the head of J.P. Morgan's Bankers Trust Company, who would eventually become the first head of the Federal Reserve System. And last, but certainly not least, was Paul Warburg. Warburg was, in fact, one of the ones involved in the financing of the Bolshevik Revolution. He was born in Germany and eventually became a naturalized American citizen. He was a partner in Cohn Loeb, and he was a representative of the Rothschild banking dynasty in England and France, where he maintained very close working relationships throughout his entire career with his brother Max Warburg, who was the head of the Warburg Banking Consortium in Germany and in the Netherlands. Paul Warburg was one of the wealthiest men in the world. In fact, those of you who remember Little Orphan Annie will remember Daddy Warbucks. Daddy Warbucks was the characterization of Paul Warburg, and everyone at the time was well aware of that fact. These were the seven men that were aboard a small railroad car who were at Jekyll Island. And as amazing as it may seem, they represented approximately a quarter of the wealth of the entire world. These are the men that sat around the table and created the Federal Reserve System. Now, these guys organized their meeting under the radar of the newsmen of the day by arriving to the area in this small train at night. And some may ask, what's the big secret? Well, the truth is, the Fed was proposed as a means of breaking the hold of the so-called money powers over the United States. And just who were these guys? They were the money powers. And if the public had known that these were the guys at the bottom of the plan for the Federal Reserve System, it would never have been able to gain the political support it needed to be enacted into law 3 years later. That was the reason for the secrecy at the meeting. Now, we know something very important about the Federal Reserve that we didn't know before, but there's much more to it than that. Consider the composition of this group. Here we had the Morgans, the Rockefellers, Cohn Loeb, the Rothschilds, and the Warburgs. These people were competitors in financial dealings. They were competitors. They were, in fact, the major world competitors in the field of investment in banking in these days. These were the giants. Prior to this period, they were beating their heads against each other, blood all over the battlefield, fighting for dominance in the financial markets of the world, not only in New York, but in London and in Paris and everywhere investment and banking was in play. And here they are at a late night meeting on a little known island off the coast of Georgia, sitting around and coming into agreement. And this is significant because it happened precisely at that point in American history where business was undergoing a major and fundamental change in ideology. Prior to this point, American business had been operating under the principles of private enterprise. Free enterprise competition is what made America great. It's what caused it to surpass all the other nations of the world. Once we had achieved that pinnacle of performance, however, this was the point in history where the shift was going away from competition and toward monopoly. This has been described in many textbooks as the dawning of the era of the cartel. And this is exactly what was happening. For the 15-year period prior to the meeting on Jekyll Island, the very investment groups about which we are speaking were coming together more and more and engaging in joint ventures rather than competing with each other. The meeting on Jekyll Island was just the culmination of that trend, where they came together completely and decided not to compete. They formed a cartel. A cartel is an arrangement by which businesses agree not to compete with one another in certain ways to enhance the profits of one another. The oil cartel is best known in today's world. I mean, we hear over and over again about how the oil industry and the foreign oil markets are collaborating in order to drive oil prices up and put us all in the poorhouse. Cartels by nature are designed to be extraordinarily profitable to their participants and reap profits from those who are not participants. This is not a very complex financial idea, but to most people in America today, it's far easier for them to wrap themselves around the idea that there's a conspiracy of Arab oil magnates that are working against them than it is for them to come to grips with the idea that they have been laboring under a financial conspiracy for over almost 100 years. And while we won't be able to finish the entire development of this conspiracy on today's program, we will revisit this next week and speak more perfectly on how the doctrine of emergency was used to garner further powers by the Federal Reserve. Things get a little more complicated with that. That's where you and I get sold into slavery until such time as the national debt is satisfied. So this was just the coming together of a bunch of businessmen in order to make an arrangement by which they could, as great, powerful financial forces, bring their power together and become even bigger. Now, many people are familiar with money creation, and some of this may be somewhat of a review for you. But it seems good if we go to the very beginning and we make this as basic and simple as we can for folks so they can understand how a monetary cartel with the authority of the federal government can, over short and particularly over long term, do extraordinary damage to the economic well-being of a country. All right, it's a very simple process, but it's one that today is conducted on computers and through arbitrage dealings between large currency traders from around the globe. And like the testimony of Jefferson about the First National Bank, these transactions are obscure to everyone but the people involved in them. The problem is the power that these transactions have financially to both affect in boom and in bust the economies of the nations around the world is extraordinary. And there are often, at least we would hope, these are unintended consequences, that there are unintended consequences of pockets of huge poverty-stricken regions throughout the world that are a result of the manipulations of these investors. We'll cover a little bit more of that, Lord willing, if we have time toward the end of the program. Here is how this stuff works. And much of this information comes from a guy named Edward Griffin. He's written a book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, one that, if you're interested in more details about this matter, is authoritative and has all of the citations of government documents and the creation of the Federal Reserve System, the bills, and the people, all of the players. Plenty of money is loaned to the government, but they never have enough. Congress always needs more money, so Congress goes down the street to the Federal Reserve Building. The Fed has been waiting for them. That's one of the reasons it was created. By the time they get inside of the Federal Reserve Building, the officer of the Fed is opening his desk drawer. He knows they're going to be there, and he's ready, and he pulls out his checkbook, and he writes a check to the U.S. Treasury for $1 billion, or whatever amount it is that they need. He signs the check and gives it to the Treasury official. Where did they get $1 billion to give to the Treasury? Who put that money into the account of the Federal Reserve System? The answer is there is no money in the account at the Federal Reserve System. In fact, technically, there isn't even an account. There's only a checkbook. That's all. That $1 billion springs into being at precisely the instant the officer signs that check, and that is called monetizing the debt. That's the phrase they throw at you. But what it means is that they write a check, a big rubber check. And as I have said before here today, if you and I were to do this, or if any other private business were to do it, they would go to jail. But they can do it because the Congress has authorized them to and wants them to do it. In fact, this is the payoff. This is the benefit of the government side of this partnership with this monetary cartel. This is how the government gets its instant access to any amount of money at any time without having to go to the taxpayer directly and justify it or ask for it. Otherwise, they would have to come to the taxpayer and say, look, we're going to raise your taxes by another $3,000 this year. And of course, if they did that, they would be voted out of office very quickly. They like this magic money system because it's a no questions asked source of money. You may have noticed that it's been many years since Congress has even discussed what anything costs. It's not an issue. It doesn't make any difference what the cost is, because regardless of the overrun, they know they can go down the street to the Federal Reserve, and by law, the officer has to write them a big check and give it to them. And they're off and running. And in case you all haven't noticed, there are now three generations of Americans enslaved to this process. And if the Lord tarries and this is not stopped, there will be a day of reckoning. It has already begun. Now, we have shown that this system forms a relationship with the banking system and the government that greatly enhances the government ability to spend with reckless abandon. But what do the banks get out of it? Let's go back to that billion-dollar check. The Treasury official deposits the check into the government's checking account, and all of a sudden, the computers start to click, and it shows that the government has a billion-dollar deposit, meaning it can now write $1 billion in checks against that deposit, which it starts to do immediately. For the sake of our analysis, let's follow just $100 of that billion in a check that for some reason they write to the fellow that delivers the mail to our door. The postal worker gets a check for $100, and he looks at this thing, and he can't imagine in his wildest dreams that that money didn't exist 2 days ago anywhere in the universe. It's spendable, so he probably wouldn't care even if you told him. He deposits it now into his personal checking account. Now we're finally out of the Federal Reserve and out of the government's check, and we're into the private banking system. We are in the part of the partnership which is involved in the cartel. $100 deposit has now been made in the local bank, and the banker sees that and runs over to the loan window and opens it up and says, "Attention, everybody, we have money to loan. Someone just deposited $100. Everyone is overjoyed at that, because that's one of the reasons they come to the bank. They come to borrow money. That's a sign of national health if you're in debt. So they're anxious to know that the bank has money to loan. They line up for the loans. They heard the banker, and they say $100 is not very much, and he says not to worry. We can loan up to $900 based on that $100 deposit. How can that be done? The Federal Reserve System requires that the banks hold no less than 10% of their deposits in reserve. The bank holds 10% of that $100 in reserve, $10, and it loans this first fellow in line $90. What does he do with it? He wants to spend it, so he puts it in his checking account. In fact, it probably goes directly into his checking account. Let's assume that they gave it to him and he puts it back. When he puts it back, it's a deposit, isn't it? Goes back into the bank as another deposit. Only a $100 deposit, but $900 in loans, and that deposit often sits in the same bank where the loan is originated. Where did the $900 come from? And the answer is the same. There was no money. This springs into existence precisely at the point where the loan is made. Notice the difference. An important distinction is when the money is created out of nothing for the government, it is spent by the government. On the banking side, however, when it's created out of nothing, when they have a 10% reserve and then they loan 10 times that money that they've just taken in, it's not spent by the banks. It is loaned by the banks to you and me, and we spend it. Notice that when they loan it to us, we have to pay them interest on it. Think about this. This money was created out of nothing, and yet they collect interest on it, which means that they collect interest on nothing. Doesn't this sound like a good deal? Don't you all wish you had a checkbook that you could write checks out of and get interest for, having to do nothing but write the check? And they loan it to folks, and we're all wrapped up in this, and it's been going on for a long, long time. Now you see that the benefit is to the banking cartel for being involved in the Federal Reserve System. Interest on nothing. The process doesn't end there, however. It has consequences for you and me. Remember the real estate bubble created by the Second National Bank? Well, what we are headed for is a perfect financial storm, and the modern real estate crisis of the last several years is just the first frontal boundary of that storm. Did any of you see your wealth disappear as the banks were recapitalized by the government and made whole? Just take a look at what you owe on your home if you happen to be paying a mortgage. CNBC reported last November that half of all U.S. mortgages are negative equity. That means your house is worth less than you owe on it. This represents much of middle-class America, whose perceived wealth rested on their home value at their projected date of retirement. Most of this wealth has been wiped out as a function of the money creation process we are dealing with here today. And the banks are getting their losses refunded because, in the words of today's politicians, they are too big to fail. But what about you and me? We are on the hook for the decades of tax liability that has been created here. As of the framing of this program, just a little less than 2 hours ago, the national debt was $15,718,804,500,000. Each taxpayer owes $138,400 to the federal government now. And the bigger picture is much worse when we include Social Security, prescription drugs, and Medicare liability, also known as unpaid for or unfunded liabilities. The number skyrockets to nearly $19 trillion. $119 trillion, excuse me. A staggering $1,046,400 per taxpayer. $1,046,400 per taxpayer. And just how do you think the authorities are going to collect this money? They will take everything you have, and then they will take you and yours. And like other nations in history, there will be nothing left.
Is true.